Blog Talk Radio.
Mojuba Akoda, Mojuba Asheda, Mojuba Aluwa Mi, Apolabi Pega, Mojuba Araba Mi, Adesanya Awuyade, Mojuba Ogute Compound Ode Remo, Mojuba Baba, Mojuba Yeye, Mojuba Egun, to all the God children, Mojuba Egun to all the Babalawos, the Ears, Mojuba Egungun to all the chiefs, Mojuba Egungun to all the Awos, Mojuba Egungun to all those that are listening, who are tuned in. We give praise and thanks to the Most High. We say Ashe, 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 Ashe-o.
Ashe-o. Welcome to Sign of the Times, everyone. This is Queen Tahira. Sign of the Times is brought to you by the UAC, the United African Coalition for Justice and Human Rights, New Power Radio Network, Work, Manhood, Race, and Culture, and Unity Design, and our newest sponsor, AAES, the All African Empowerment Society. Please check them out on Facebook. Manhood, Race, and Culture can be found on the World Wide Web at manhoodraceculture.com. Unity Design, Unity is spelled UNITEE. Please reach out to them on the World Wide Web at unitydesign.com and aaesociety.org on the World Wide Web. Please check them out. And this Friday is the Friday for AAES with my beloved brother, Laquay Jewell. So please tune in on Friday night. And tomorrow night, beginning at 6 p.m., my sister, Queen Dara, and myself are going to have a Sisters of the Soul dialogue and discuss how important it is to have family, friends, and loved ones involved in the lives of our confined citizens. And so tonight, we have the honor of having Dr. James Jones join us on a Wednesday instead of a Tuesday this week. Peace, Dr. Jones. How are you doing this evening?
I'm great, Queen. I'm great. I'm great. How are you doing today?
I'm pretty fair, four square. I can't complain. It won't do no good, no way. Only thing we got to do is figure out how to yin-yang the situation and make the best out of it.
I hear you. I hear you. I definitely hear you.
How was your trip?
It was good. It was good. You know, got pretty much everything that I needed to get done work-wise done. Didn't get everything I needed to get done personally, you know, visiting family and all that done. You know, just quite simply didn't have enough time to see everyone. But the trip was good. But I'm glad to be off the road and back home.
I say. Well, we didn't get a chance to do a broadcast last night. I messed up. I didn't know that I couldn't schedule more than one broadcast a day. I thought we had the same, I guess, benefits as we had before, but evidently not. And I went to schedule a second broadcast and it wouldn't go through. So thank you for taking the time to be with us tonight on a Wednesday instead of a Tuesday. We appreciate that.
Oh, well, you know, I just always enjoy, you know, being with you, talking and what have you, anytime, you know, literally anytime. So I am here.
Where do you want to start tonight?
You know, I want to start with a piece dealing with something that I know is near and dear to your heart. It's near and dear to my heart, and it's one of the things that I dealt with during the portion of my trip that I spent in New York, specifically Harlem and Brooklyn. The issue is gentrification and how we seem to not be able, it's as if other groups are running at a quantum speed and we're actually going backwards. You know, we're being very loud about things. We're being very, you know, vocal about things. But when you add it all up, I think that the issue of gentrification highlights many of the problems that we have with black leaders and really shows very clearly that instead of having proactive leadership, really what we have are a bunch of reactionary ambulance chasing leaders, you know, who are frequently out in public talking loud but really saying nothing, especially nothing that they're ever going to put any power or fight behind. So I'd like to start there, dealing with gentrification, and then maybe for the second hour we can pick up something a little bit different other than
okay, that sounds good to me.
Do two different
things. Yeah, that
things.
Sounds
so,
good.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and just jump into it, and hopefully we have others who want to jump in and chime in on this issue. So the piece that I'm getting ready to read comes from my site, manhoodraceculture.com, and it is titled "How Gentrification Once Again Highlights the Ineptitude of So-Called Black Leaders." So let's go ahead and get into it. Here it is. I do not care if you're talking about Harlem, Houston, or Brooklyn. There appears to be a few certainties, such as black-on-black crime, poverty, police brutality, inferior educational institutions, an absence of black leadership, and economic exploitation of inner-city residents by people who do not look like them. Although the aforementioned ills significantly impact the lives of African-American urbanites, as I pen this piece, there is no doubt that the most pernicious danger of all is gentrification. What exactly is gentrification? A working definition of gentrification is to renovate and improve a housing district so that it conforms to middle-class taste, meaning to make people and their way of life more refined or dignified. Make no mistake about it, gentrification has been occurring, and there is not much that a disassembled community such as ours can do about it. In fact, things have gotten so bad within the Black community that there is a segment of Black America that is welcoming gentrification. Damon Thomas, a teacher who left Harlem and relocated to Brooklyn due to a skyrocketing real estate market, shared that, and I quote, "It," meaning gentrification, "is in many ways a double-edged sword. With the arrival of other groups who have significant financial means come several things. A, better city services. B, businesses in the form of restaurants, retail, etc. C, the diluting of cultural flavor. And D, the destruction of our political base." Retired school teacher Carl Scott extended Thomas's sentiments by relating, and I quote, "There is one thing that has occurred in Harlem with the influx of whites. Crime has somewhat decreased. Regardless of what one says about this matter, the issue of black-on-black crime has not been adequately addressed within or acted upon in a serious way by our community. Man, I'll tell you, those perpetrating black-on-black crime have made me reverse my opposition to the arrival of whites in Harlem. I guess that you can consider them somewhat of a necessary evil," end quote. Quite possibly, the most disappointing aspect of historic Black neighborhoods' disappearance, beyond its disappearance in general, has to be the total lack of a significant, meaning something beyond a community meeting or angry, outlandish public statement with absolutely no teeth behind it, response by African-American political leaders. Unfortunately for African-Americans who have been privileged to reside in historic Black neighborhoods, the African-American community rarely has a response to white urban developers' encroachment upon historically Black areas. It is during what should be highly contentious battles over America's central cities that the saying, "money talks and bullshit walks," comes to life and displays the gross disparities between African-Americans and other groups in regards to education, skill, economic resources, political acumen, and economic collectivism. No moment more clearly displays the gross lack of power Black leaders hold than when other racial or ethnic groups enter historic Black areas and swiftly capture its political base and real estate market. What is the Black response to such encroachment? Embarrassingly, it appears that so-called Black leaders have little response at their disposal beyond yet another public forum that invariably denigrates into yet another griping session or an even more ridiculous action such as calling the community together for a barbecue. It is for this reason that I maintain that there is a woeful lack of Black leadership within our communities. What we presently have is not leadership, rather a reactionary cadre of individuals who offer blasé commentary regarding political economic developments that even they realize that they have no chance of reversing. The most upsetting aspect of these developments is that matters such as gentrification would not be occurring if our community had placed their emphasis upon long-lasting things such as education, economic collectivism, and politicization. Ironically, it is these simple building blocks that have repeatedly been used by those who opportunistically exploit disassembled communities such as our own at every turn. Unfortunately for the African-American children who will inherit this mess that contemporary Black America has created, so-called Black leaders are not interested in working towards the creation of Saturday schools, advocating for circulating our dollar within our own community, or raising funds for the independent Black school movement. It is for the above reasons that whites and truly every other group will continue to do whatever they desire with the African-American community, including extinguishing its existence when it benefits them. Inexplicably, while so-called Black leaders continue their self-promotion campaigns and the Black community is still being exploited, a sizable portion of our community will fall behind their chosen leader and cheer him on as he takes them closer and closer to an abyss. It is most certainly time that African Americans divest from this cult-like fascination with charismatic Black leaders and realize that such individuals are extending one of the greatest traditions of futility civilized man has ever known. That tradition is none other than talking loud and saying nothing. If the loss of historic black communities has taught us nothing else, it is that when it comes to real-world matters such as economics, politics, and real estate, then money talks and bullshit walks. And I'm certain that you would agree that our cadre of so-called black leaders have been bullshitting for far too long. I just wonder, when will our people tire of their antics and adopt a position that calls each and every one of us to take responsibility for ourselves and work collectively to uplift the entire race? In the words of Marcus Mosiah Garvey, up you mighty race, achieve what you will. And that's the piece right there, Queen.
Word, Dr. Jones. Thank you so much. You touched on a lot of things. I want to go back to the first part of the piece, if you don't mind, where you say that the person speaks on the things that supposedly are beneficial or happen as a result of gentrification. You read off a few things. Can you go back and reread those things for me? Did I lose you, Dr. Jones?
You lost me to the mute button. Sorry about that. Oh, okay, here it is.
That's okay.
Gentrification is in many ways a double-edged sword. With the arrival of other groups who have significant financial means come several things. A, better city services. B, more businesses in the form of restaurants, retail, et cetera. However, it also includes the diluting of cultural flavor and the destruction of our political base. And the second individual said, quite simply, it was the quote about the black-on-black crime and how that has reversed his position. I'm not sure if that's the quote that you wanted.
Yes, that first one was the one that I wanted to start with.
Okay.
And the things that he talks about are true, that there is an increase in the services from the city and the responses that you get from even the police and fire when gentrification takes place. But my question is, why is that? And he's right. There are businesses that do become a new part of the community. But what I found when Over the Rhine was being gentrified and still is that the people who live there can't afford those businesses. Those businesses make the majority of their money with the party crowd that comes in to show that they're making their footprint. But until gentrification is fully, seen and brought into fruition and manifested itself, they keep their distance until they can own the block. So, again, my question is why? So I don't know where to really begin, the rest of the conversation, Dr. Jones, because I've been through it, and you have too, seeing it happen in Houston, and I'd love to hear what you saw when you went to New York that solidified that gentrification is there and rearing its ugly head. But, you know, why? Why is it and how is it that city after city and community after community, it's so easy for the powers that be to take over in the manner in which they do with no regards to how much collateral damage they may cause? And I yield.
You know, the thing for me, and especially, well, you asked a bunch of questions there, so let me try and address each one of them. Why are they able to do it? Truth of the matter is that they have the economic might and political organization behind them. And we are, for all intents and purposes, a disassembled, unorganized community, regardless of what area you're looking at. We're in many ways situated and positioned at such a weak point that anybody, and I mean anybody, who chooses to concentrate their efforts on exploiting us will succeed. One of the other questions that I heard you ask was the idea of how is it that, that the businesses come and our people can't even patronize them. They don't have the monetary resources to patronize them. You're absolutely right on one hand, but then there's this other thing that occurs. And while I was in Harlem, and I had the pleasure of, we went down 125th Street, and we were heading back. We were turning off 125th Street, and I looked up, and there walking towards me in the crowd was one of my former students who related that he now lived in Harlem. He had moved from Houston to Harlem, and he was trying to start up an independent Afrocentric black school, but he was having a heck of a time trying to get that thing going. However, as we walked up the block, we went past all of these obviously new businesses. They weren't, you know, there before. And we ended up going into, I want to say it's called Harlem Underground. It was like a T-shirt shop that was next to a restaurant. And we talked with the brother who was working in a T-shirt shop. He looked like the owner, but he said that he was not the owner, that it was his dad's shop, and his dad owned everything on that block. And he was an African-American male. While we're talking, these two sisters came in, and, you know, one of them began to talk as if she was drunk or something. And turns out, this is maybe at noon, she had been to the restaurant next to it, and she shared that she couldn't purchase anything because she had spent all of her money in that restaurant drinking mimosas or something. So it's, you know, for me, it's one of those where big bank take little bank. And you do have some presence of African-American business persons in Harlem who are trying to compete and are trying to make it. But it's a situation where it appears to be very, very, very individualistic. They're in that game almost by themselves. And that stands in stark contrast to what we saw when we were in Harlem in Bedford-Stuyvesant, where we see this humongous population of Hasidic Jews who are going about, you know, you could tell that they ran that area. And when you would see them in an African-American enclave of Bed-Stuy, you knew they were there to collect rent. They were there to do business or something like that. And so, you know, I don't know if that answers your question, but I think that it's a total breakdown of African-Americans being able to in any way take care of, support each other, or handle their own business. And I yield with that, Queen.
Yeah, that I guess puts things into a better perspective. And when you speak of the political and economics of it all, you know, you can't help but acknowledge that, you know, Dr. Claude Anderson has been trying to teach and preach that for quite some time, and only a few of us are getting it. Let me ask you just, Dr. Jones, do you think that the reward for those who in the community act as gatekeepers and I guess do benefit from gentrification and meritorious manumission, whether they recognize it to be that or not, do you think that is just as heavily influential on our position?
You know, I don't know. You know, I thought about that, and I thought about that while I was actually up in Harlem. And one of the things that has occurred to me, and it's one of the things that may be very difficult for us to accept. But it almost seems as if the idea of meritorious manumission, of receiving something for selling your people out, I'm really beginning to doubt in this present day, in the two areas that I saw, Houston and also Harlem. I'm doubting if there are really African Americans who are holding that type of power anymore, where they could actually offer anything to someone that they would want. I'm thinking that these people are just taking what it is they want. They're buffaloing their way in, and they're not in any way being persuaded to even have to deal with African Americans anymore. You know, for instance, Harlem had, you know, that Charlie Rangel is finally leaving the House of Representatives. Well, he took over for Adam Clayton Powell Jr. And you think about how long that's been since Powell was there. But it turned into a battle between I want to say he was a Puerto Rican politician, and the heir apparent to Charlie Rangel, the individual that he was trying to bequeath his position to, that brother lost. Harlem voted for the Hispanic male, and many parts of Black Harlem voted for the Hispanic male, to be honest with you. So it's not one of those situations where people are necessarily, how can I put this, where people are necessarily allowing themselves to be characterized totally by the race card anymore. Or maybe they just aren't participating in the system at all. You know, and that's another very real possibility that's going on. But as far as seeing others have to come in and deal with our people, no, I'm not really seeing that. Not in the two situations that I saw. I just think that we're so powerless that we can't do anything.
Yeah. Well, do you think if what you're saying is true about us, you know, I guess our armor having so many kinks in it that, you know, we've become weakened to the system, how much do you think the fact that a lot of our brothers have become subjected to the judicial system and being entangled in that with the high percentage of males, not that that's the only ism, I guess, in our community, but how much do you think that that has to do with, you know, the condition our condition is in, that there are so many families out here who have loved ones who are incarcerated?
You know, it all goes together. You can't separate gentrification from the prison industrial complex. You can't separate gentrification from single parent households. It all kind of goes together as a system. And one of the things for me, and I'm, you know that I'm totally against being a conspiracy buff. However, what I will say about these situations is quite simply, I think that when that system is rolling along, where you have a absence of economic opportunities, which leads to crime, which leads to incarceration, which leads to a disassembled community, which is a part of a larger disassembled community, it's difficult to reverse that in every way. It's very, very, very difficult to reverse that. And so I would say that brothers being locked up is quite simply just a symbol, another part of this entire system, because the lack of economic opportunity leads to crime, and it leads to depressed real estate values, which makes it all the more easier for those who have jobs, who have been able to circulate their dollar, but also go out and capture your dollar and put it in their community. It makes it all the more easier for them to literally capture land, capture a community. And there's really nothing that you can do because all of your resources are, number one, scattered, and number two, haven't been collected and added to traditionally like other people have done. You know, you don't see, once again, the Hasidic Jew community, you don't see them going to jail, okay? You don't see them being victimized by officers, but you see poor black people experiencing those things. And it's all representative of a failure and a lack of really understanding the science of community and how to live as a civilized people. And I yield with that, Queen.
Yeah, I played a listening learn session with Noam Chomsky, and he talks about what you just said, the fact that there are so many connections, you know, throughout the system, and the fact that we, are guilty of falling for the okey-doke for so long to where we don't even recognize it anymore. So that's why, you know, I know that there is a big push for all African societies, all African, property and land in different places throughout the U.S. But to me, I don't know if I'm right or wrong about this, but I can't see us separating and operating in a silo like that and not be more vulnerable than we are right now to the very same system that we, many of us are trying and claiming to steering away from. And what I mean by that, not that we need, you know, so-called need the white man and the things that we do. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that there are so many things that we don't have control of that eventually there's going to have to be some cross-communication, some cross, businesses and things like that that will have to happen in order for us to survive. So what do you think about that, Dr. Jones? Is it possible for us to live in an all-African society and still be in the U.S.?
You know, this is my thing, and ironically, I was talking about this yesterday with a young brother who is aspiring, from my perspective, to be the next great Muslim orator, because he would just talk and talk and talk and talk, and he's using the Bible and the Quran and all that going on. And I pointed out to him that it is truly unrealistic, foolhardy even, for us to think that a plan like that was created by the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, of having 5-6 southern states be all black and white folk would leave and we would secede, you know, those positions to African Americans. You know, that's not even worth discussing because it's never going to happen. That's number one. But I think that what we need to be doing is replicating, and I'm telling people almost on a consistent basis, on a daily basis now, you know, stop hating, you know, emulate. We need to pay attention to what other groups have done, you know, and what other groups have done. They haven't come out and just publicly been, oh, well, we need a separate black land. We need a separate area for us. What they've done is they've been very busy, very strategic, very covert about making that very thing happen without even announcing it. You know, when you think about the segregation that we have within American cities about 1900, where you had an area where the Italians lived, the Germans lived, the Russians lived, where black folk lived. When you look at that type of thing, that's wholly doable. And that's what we're seeing be done, you know, on a repeated basis. What is going on with gentrification is just quite simply the shifting of land in hands. One group is losing real estate and losing land, and another more powerful group has taken it over. And so I think it's realistic. It is doable. for us to have a area of our town. Hell, we already have that. You know, we know now from looking at educational studies that our schools, which are based upon residents, are more segregated today than they were prior to the Brown versus Board of Education decision. So us being together is not the issue. The issue is, do we have the courage to put up walls, and of course they're theoretical walls, that would keep other groups who have been able to historically not only raid our communities, gather our resources, and exit on a nightly basis to their community, do we have the courage to fight against that, number one? And then also, do we have the intelligence to support our own businesses that are put up? Because I'll tell you, one of my wife works on a street called Alameda. Alameda is black. It is a black street. Black people live there. Black homeowners, black renters, and the black homeless are all on Alameda. In any time of the day that you go to Chicken and Rice, number one, on Alameda, run exclusively by an Asian couple, you see black ownership, black homeowners, black renters, and the black homeless in Chicken and Rice, number one, buying up that chicken. And when you really think about it, the association between black folk and the love of fried chicken, and think how ludicrous it is that some Asians could come into a black community with their historic love of fried chicken and be able to sell them fried chicken and take their money and leave the community. It is absolutely absurd. So the question of can we live together has already been answered. But the other questions have been answered as well, that we refuse to build walls and we refuse to patronize our own. And I yield with that, Queen.
Ashe, you know, you're right again. In trying to work here in Cincinnati on a collective effort to unify the community, one of our stumbling blocks to stop gentrification is and has been those who want to acclimate, those who want to fit in, those who want to, I guess, for lack of a better reference, be accepted by the very society that created the laws that oppress us, that created the ability to use the court system and manipulate the court system to the fact that to the point where we're, you know, more there are more of us incarcerated than any other nationality of people, and we've got a reputation here in Hamilton County that's known throughout the U.S. as far as sending people to life without parole. Imam Hassan was specifically sent to Hamilton County because he knew, they knew, the system knew that the court system here was so intricately woven that, you know, they could sentence him to life and pretty much get away with it. And he spent all this time in an appeal status. So, okay, we are basically funding, you know, let it be told, our own genocide, our own gentrification of our culture and our community. It was so hurtful to see how much Over the Rhine has changed in the year that I haven't been there, you know, since I got gentrified out of the community, to see these arrogant Europeans walk up and down the streets with no regard for where their animals cross, no regard for the fact that, you know, their animals are coming in close proximity to women pushing strollers. And I can't think of a community right now that I'd rather not be in than the one that I loved so much not too long ago than Over the Rhine. And, you know, people have talked to me about coming back and still, you know, staking my claim, which, you know, the development corporation that I head up is not gone. It's not going anywhere. And, you know, right now we have an agreement from the city to communicate with us per their own agreement that goes back to February of this year. And I have yet to get one correspondence from them. So what do we, for those of us who do speak up, for those who do speak truth to power, for those of us who are not afraid to continue to try and persevere despite those obstacles, do we need to be looking more so on an international level than we do on a local level? Because it seems like we get more support here from outsiders than we do from the people who are right next door almost. So do you have any theory on that, or is there some sort of societal incident that occurred that made that true? You know, what's going on as far as that goes in your perspective? And I yield.
You know, the thing is that several things need to be said about, you know, what your point just was. And quite possibly the most important one is that it drives home the importance of being able to touch the minds of your children. Because the inability to touch the minds of your children is going to severely hamper you in the long term. As far as you're talking about the politicization of a community, what we're talking about is a group of individuals, a disassembled community, who have been taught in many ways that politics does not matter, that things that are not in the immediate future, instant gratification, that's where you're supposed to put, you know, the lion's share of your interest in your political, in your energies in general, even your thoughts. They've got us, and that's the only way that you can really even address it. The fact that we're talking about, you know, reacting to what it is that they're doing. As long as we're reacting and we're not issuing a claim, we're not issuing a program, we haven't developed an agenda, we're going to continue to lose time after time after time after time. Towards your point of us funding the very system that is oppressing us, I would argue that we're all funding that same system, regardless of who you are, because the system is predicated upon the decisions of individuals who have been elected. And so if we look at it that way, I think that it would be in our best interest to go ahead and really, and I mean really, put our energy behind political mobilization on a mass scale. The problem with that is that our people have developed an appetite for the sensational, for the immediate. They want to go out into the street and shut down a highway. What difference does that make in the long run? It makes none. Whereas if they had used that exact same energy to elect a commissioner, we could have someone inside the system altering and changing the rules to benefit us. But as long as we're practicing what amounts to as a losing, ignorant strategy that is not undergirded or based upon either politics or economics, we're going to continue to lose, because those are the arenas that matter. And those are the arenas that you see other groups continually focused upon: politics, economics, circulating your dollar. And here we are talking about the latest police shooting. Not that it doesn't matter, that police brutality doesn't matter, but the truth of the matter is that the reason that you have such gross negligence in regards to police brutality is because you are not politicized. We're not the only ones who drive cars, but we're the only ones who get shot while driving cars. That's a political matter. Fred Hampton, Chairman Fred Hampton, said it this way. He said, "Politics is nothing but war without bloodshed, and war is nothing but politics with bloodshed." And until we can get our people to develop an appetite for revolutionary consciousness, and have that revolutionary consciousness be undergirded by real world things and not foolishness like conspiracy theories. You know, I heard a brother say, "Oh no, you know, because you got to remember that it was written into the Constitution that by this year they would get the central cities back." That's not true. you know, and all of this intergalactic talk that our people do, it reeks of cowardice. It is not an alien that is oppressing you. It is not, you know, some song you heard that is oppressing you. What is oppressing you is the individual that is now inside of your community. So buck up, recognize what the problem is, and develop a plan and courage to go and confront them in the same manner that they confronted you by using political violence and economic violence. And make no mistake about it, that's what we're dealing with. And until we recognize it as that, we will continue to lose. And I yield with that, Queen.
All right. I agree. For those who are listening on your phone, please push 1 to come into the host queue and be a part of the conversation. If you're listening on your computer, the number to dial in is 917-889-8059, 917-889-8059. And we will connect you right away to be a part of the call. So, Dr. Jones, we've been at this for quite a while with building the dialogue and I guess creating or at least trying to create an atmosphere where people could feel comfortable enough to come to the table and offer their, I guess, 2 cents, if you will, as a part of the solution. And here it is, there's still just a few of us, and a few committed across the nation, but still just a few. So who and how do we get more people to the table to, I guess, invest their energy in the direction that we need to, or is this just something that we're going to have to put together as a collective body and accept the fact that, you know, we're not where we need to be as a people, and we have to work with what we have.
I mean, it's like anything else. You have to work with what you have, and you build and you build and you build and you build. You know, the fact that and this in many ways is one of our greatest weaknesses is that we come from historically a position and tradition of collectivism. And it's that love that those of us who do this work have for our own people that leads us to repeatedly pause and to say quite simply, no, we can't move yet because the people are not ready. We can't move because we don't want to leave anyone behind. And I am telling you that that position right there is one of the greatest things that will hinder us. Because the way that other people look at it and the way that other people handle this matter is quite simply, listen, let's move. And if they decide to save themselves, they'll catch up. We don't look at it that way. We look at it as, no, we got to get them ready because we're all going to move together as a collective. Whereas if we're replicating the programs of success of other people, we need to just build with what we have. And it's one of the things for me that I attempt to do on a daily basis from the podium that I lecture from. You know, the idea that quite simply, listen, what we're going to do is we're moving. And if you're not ready to move with us, that's all well and good, but I'm building and I'm working with those who have a mindset that they want to really move. And so it's doing everything that you can with what resources you have available. But the truth of the matter is quite simply that we have to always adhere to what I would term to be the number one rule when you're talking about doing any work aimed at uplifting African Americans. And that number one rule is quite simply that African Americans are going to break your heart. At every turn, at every moment, they're going to break your heart because they're going to resist freedom because in many ways they have become very comfortable with being oppressed. Their oppression is comfortable. It is familiar. And until they can get out of that, there is not going to be any saving of that individual right there. So those of us who are conscious, those of us who are ready, we need to go ahead and move on. And it's not leaving them behind. It is building something so when they do come into some semblance of a appropriate consciousness, they're going to be able to go ahead and have something to come to. It's in many ways, if we look at it that way, it is an act of kindness that we are doing for them. We are preparing a place for them. It may not be heaven, but we're preparing a place for them to come and for them to join us at. And I yield with that, Queen.
Ashe. And that's where I wrestled for a long time with that very decision, Dr. Jones. But you're right. Our people will, they will disappoint you. They will hurt your feelings. And some of it, we're not even aware, I think, sometimes of how some of the decisions that we make and the things that we say hurt and affect our people, whether it be right now, midterm, or long term. That energy is still there, and that seed has been planted. And it was tough to come to the conclusion that despite that, we still needed to persevere anyway. I had a European once tell me when I was thinking about stopping the development corporation and giving up with my youth group, and I had witnessed enough bad things in OTR, and she said to me, she said, if you don't do it, who will? And the more and more I thought about who was around me and who the political heads were in the community, I couldn't just walk away from something, especially after we had invested so much time and love and blood and sweat and tears into it. And that's the way I feel about the UAC and manhood raising culture and Sign of the Times and the freedom movement. Like, we've invested so much time and energy into making this thing work that, you know, it's like I refuse to allow it to fail. So if it's not going to fail, then we can't continue to do the same things that we've always done and expect a different result. And so that's where we are, Dr. Jones, with moving forward with Sign of the Times, New Power Radio Network, and all the things that we've worked so hard to accomplish over the past 3 or 4 years. That's where we are. Like, it's going to take some more people coming to the table who can help with the vision that we have in order to really for it to work the way I know, you know, and all of those who have invested the amount of time that we have into it know that it can. So I do believe that we're doing the right thing. We're on the right track. It's just going to take a lot more work and a lot more energy. And the more people that we have at the table who are like-minded enough to be able to be mature enough to agree to disagree and still move on, I think the better off we're going to be, no matter what nationality they may be. And that's just the crossroads where we're at. So I yield back to you.
You know, the thing is, and I agree with your sentiments wholeheartedly, but the thing is quite simply that we have to face facts that what we're doing is we are facing a monster. We're facing something that our people have never really faced at any time in history. And it is, quite simply, we're fighting a dysfunctional culture. We're fighting a disorganization of personal political priorities. We're fighting a host of things that we've never fought previously. And as a result of that, our strategies have to change. What we do has to change markedly. Okay? And until we get that lesson, until we get that understanding that we got to change, we got to continue to work diligently, but we also have to be realistic in understanding the battle that we're facing. But we also have to do this other thing, which is quite simply congratulate one another and support one another. And I'll be honest with you, I see very little of that in regards to our people often. I see a lot of rivalry. I see a lot of competition, but I see very, very little support, very few encouraging words and what have you. And, you know, it just is what it is. It's amazing to me. It's one of the things that I've always said, that everything seems to be more difficult and harder when you're talking about African Americans. If you're black and you're doing it, it's going to be much more difficult, because not only do you have the system to fight against, you also have your people within the system to fight against. You also have those who are jockeying outside of the system that are trying to knock you down and dissuade you for whatever reason that may be. It's sad, but it's true. But I'm just an advocate for using what you have and moving forward and not really paying attention to the naysayers and the things that are around you that would be super, 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 super duper discouraging. And I yield with that point.
Well, tomorrow is a new day, and we have the ability at any point to have the paradigm shift that it's going to take to, I guess, accomplish the things that we say we want to accomplish, and doing so and linking up with the people that we know can help us to accomplish it. So we're going to take a quick break. We're almost to the top of the hour. You're listening to Sign of the Times Blog Talk Radio, brought to you by New Power Radio Network. We'll be right back.
Put this on YouTube.
Yeah.
You heard this, dude.
I believe our greatest need as a people is to educate our youth. I believe that we need to move from all of the individuals and groups who are doing great things in their communities to uplift kids through better education, but we need to move from fragmentation to consolidation to coalition. They are simply products that help to create awareness.
Anytime you can put a symbol on a t-shirt that symbolizes unity, that's what we're doing.
Something for people to rally around. I use the colors of red, black, and green to reconnect African American youth with their culture. How do you know where you're going if you don't know where you've been and what you've been through as a people? At best, we are strongest together. And in that sense, I am driven and passionate about talking to as many people and groups all over this country who, again, want to help to maximize the mission, want to help to move forward our kids with better educational opportunities.
Hello, my name is Dr. James Thomas Jones III, and I am the author of an exciting new book titled Obruni, An African-American Odyssey Home. Most African-Americans have some desire to discover where they are originally from. Obruni is the story of my personal journey to find my ancestral home. Through a host of twists and turns, I must relate that I was able to have many of my most pressing questions regarding who I am and where I come from answered by some of the least likely sources. In fact, I was able to discover some surprising things during my trip to Ghana. If such things interest you, please support A Black Writer and visit Amazon.com and pick up your copy of Obruni, An African-American Odyssey Home, today. Thank you.
Brother, brother. brother. There's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and kiss here today. Picket lines and picket signs, don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
Everybody, this is Queen Tahira. You're listening to Sign of the Times, brought to you by the UAC and New Power Radio Network. I want to remind everyone that you can reach out to us as part of the Sign of the Times and let us know if there are some topics that you would like to discuss. Please reach out to us on Facebook as Sign of the Times, New Power Radio Network. Myself is Queen Tahira, James Jones, as well as Manhood, Race, and Culture. And let me pick another page that we have. If Zimmerman walks, we all walk. Blackout NYC, which is where we planted our feet and began our roots right after the unjust Zimmerman verdict of July 2013. So tonight we began tonight's conversation with speaking on gentrification. And I want to read the, I guess, the dictionary's definition of what gentrification is. It says, when people with money start fixing up poor neighborhoods, that's gentrification. Sounds great, except it usually means the poor residents can't afford to live there anymore and have to move. And I think that that pretty much sums up a very good definition of what gentrification is and what I've seen it be here in Cincinnati, Ohio. So peace, Dr. Jones. Welcome back.
Peace, Queen.
I think
peace,
you
Queen.
Might be muted.
Peace, Queen.
Okay.
Yeah, I was muted. It took me a second to get to the phone screen. Yeah, I mean that's in a that's in a nutshell what gentrification actually is. People are going to be pushed out if they're not pushed out through unscrupulous ways. They're going to just quite simply continue to raise the property taxes to a point where they can no longer afford to pay them, and they're going to lose their property that way. So, yeah, you know, that's it's an unscrupulous practice that is been repeatedly done and will continue to be done.
You know, Dr. Jones, when you speak about the portion of how taxes and property taxes are raised to the point of unaffordability, do you know that they've been doing that to us since those of us who were able to get any land through the Freedmen's Bureau? That's what they did to them. So that policy and practice is not new to us as a group of people. I don't know why, like in 2016, folks are able to still get by with it.
You know, the thing is that those are the existing rules. And these are people who rig the game for their own good, and they decide that, you know, they're going to use it for whatever means, and they have no shame about using it for whatever means. If they're able to, in many ways, get ahead, they're going to go ahead and they're going to get ahead by doing it. And that, mm-hmm. that's not a problem. It's not a problem for them. They sleep well at night. They actually celebrate their victory, celebrate that they've mm-hmm. been able to get over on somebody.
Yeah, a friend of mine had posted that she was in one of the ice cream shops on Vine Street and was kicked by a European's daughter. And she said at first she, you know, didn't say anything. She just turned around and looked. And you know how when a black woman gives you the eye, you know the feeling that puts mm-hmm. in you. So you know when something is up. And she says, you know, aren't you going to say anything? And he said, what? Like, he, you know, like, how dare you even say anything about the fact that she kicked you? She's a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, your daughter kicked me. And he said, you know, in a really mean way, oh, sorry. You know, but you could tell that he just didn't mean it. And, you know, that's just one small incident of how arrogant a lot of the people who are a part of that system, a part of the gentrification cycle, how arrogant they become and how quickly they become that way until there's a threat of some uprising, until there's a threat of, I guess, a backlash from it on a large political scale, which, you know, because this person is one of those gatekeepers, it turned out to be that it was some backlash for, you know, the European community to kind of check themselves in the manner in which they were dealing with the black residents in over the Rhine. But had she not been who she was and in trying to fit in and so accepted by these Europeans, I wonder if it would have really mattered. For example, how they, you know, how they did me. There were a lot of people who could have said something that didn't because of who I am and was in the community. So it's a different, I guess, a delicate kind of dance in navigating through to know who is exactly on our side and who is not. But to mm-hmm. me, once they expose themselves to be that way, it's up to us to check them and to make sure that, you know, they recognize that everybody's not going to be a part of just wanting to sit in and acquiescing to what it is that they say that they want. Especially in our community, and I
yield. Yeah, I mean, it's a situation where, quite simply, you know, we know the truth, and we know that we can't stereotype everyone as being, you know, quote unquote bad. Yet at the exact same time, we have to recognize that we really do need to be very mindful and very cognizant of the reality that this ain't their first time at the rodeo. And one thing we know for sure is that when historic black areas are lost, they're gone forever. They're never going to mm-hmm. relinquish them. They pass their property down through generations. You know, I would venture to guess that you have some whites who still own the very land that our people worked on. As far as plantation go, that land has never left that family's home, that family's control and hand. So they are who they are, you know. And one of the things for me is I really wish that our people would take a position where they would no longer front. about what the real situation actually is, and be able to have a raw, honest conversation amongst ourselves about what the positives and what the negatives are that are occurring within our community, and make a concerted effort to go ahead and address them and fix those issues. But we haven't hit the rock bottom point, I believe, for us to have that discussion, because we still have not had that discussion, not in a way that would allow us to be proactive and constructive in regards to making it happen going forward to improve our community and protect our community, protect our land.
Definitely. We've come to the point that for those of us who have been able to manage to hang on to property and things like that, we really need to do all we can to make sure that we, pay taxes as much as we can and do what we need to do to hold on to it. Because you're right, they do leave their heirs, if you will, their property. And working with the Free Alabama Movement, you can see it there in the southern states, especially where when you look at the correctional facilities from an aerial view, they're set up just like a plantation or a farm type of atmosphere. And in the center is like a command center, and then surrounding it are the pods or whatever. But beyond that, for acres and acres and acres, is farmland, is field. And so somebody owns that property. Somebody has the title and deed to what goes on that land. So the cycle, if you will, of how they're making hand over fist and money and resources in our state of oppression, it does go back that far. It's plain to see when you start to look at, what's right in front of you, not just basing what you may think on what you hear or one flash in the pan type of story you may hear. No, the reality of it is that these people do still own the same land, like you said, that our ancestors worked in. Right now, those who are confined citizens are the modern-day slaves that are still working that land to this day. So you're absolutely right, Dr. Brown.
You know, the thing is that when we really take a look at the entire context of what's going on, in its entirety, it's a daunting, sad situation, because quite simply, we've apparently not been able to get beyond whatever it is that we need to get beyond to be a unified front to battle against these people who have historically and contemporarily oppressed our community and our kind. And for the life of me, I'm unsure what it would take to get us to mobilize to do such things. It almost appears as if we're too busy trying to keep our head above water that we don't pay any attention to the oppression that our people are experiencing, that we are experiencing on a daily basis. And I yield with that, Queen.
Now, I want to talk about certain aspect of instilling fear in our people to either speak up, speak truth to power, stand their ground, commit economic suicide, whatever soapbox or platform we choose to take, that there's a certain amount of fear and righteous fear, because we don't know what kind of political ties or whatever the oppressor may unleash on us once we do those things. So something that happened down in your area, Dr. Jones, was the white supremacists that decided that they were going to take up camp in front of the local NAACP office Have you heard about that story, and what is your perspective on that?
Yeah, I not only heard about it, I actually wrote a piece about that. You know, it's hilarious to me. And matter of fact, when you were when I was talking about chicken and rice number one on Alameda, where all the black folk are at, that protest was on Alameda, basically. The NAACP is on a street that's right off of Alameda. So it's full of black folk right there. It's right next to what we could argue for the third ward here in Houston is the center of its cultural life, the SHAPE Community Center. So, but what do I think about it? I mean, it takes a lot of nerve, a lot of gall to do that. But also, in many ways, it highlighted for me how little bit of understanding those type of people actually have about what it is they're attempting to articulate and say and do. It was, you know, for me, on many levels, it was kind of hilarious. I read some of the I won't name because I'm sure they'll sue me if I name them, but one of the local black papers here. And their write-up about it, not only was the write-up, did it just now hit the paper today, but also it was a quick four sentences that tried to deal with it and said, well, they hurried up and got out of town, went out of Dodge when our boys showed up with the choppers. You know, and I'm like, oh, my God, that's a black newspaper that's writing at that poor of a level. But
oh my God!
You know, a part of me just kind of looked at it as par for the course. You know, the crazy stuff that occurs.
So is the NAACP office there? Because I know the condition our NAACP office is in here in Cincinnati, and I'm not going to get on that soapbox because I want to learn more. I want to hear from you. Like, is the NAACP office there in Houston? Are they active in the black community, or is it pretty much a figurehead organization and is kind of, I guess, rolled out when it needs to be rolled out?
Yeah, it would be a figurehead and rolled out when it needs to be rolled out. The far more active civil rights organization in this city would be the National Urban League. They're consistently doing something, but the
mm-hmm.
NAACP would be more of a figurehead. And it, you know, if you look at it, the area that it's in, the condition even of the building is something that is in many ways shameful. You know, in every way is shameful. So, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So is there the Urban League there in Houston is really active. Was there any reaction from the community itself when the demonstration took place, or was it, do you think that it was so overdone and over so quickly that people didn't have an opportunity to really react?
I think it was the latter, that it happened so quickly that people really didn't have much of an opportunity to react to it. However, at the exact same time, I think that even if they had advance notice that it was going to occur, if, you know, all of those things were, you know, known, I don't see them as being able to do much outside of stand across from them and hoop and holler and scream. One of the more unfortunate things for me, having worked with some of the quote unquote civil rights groups here, most notably the Nation of Islam, it's in many ways a poor facsimile of black activism, to be honest with you. It's something that would really in many ways make you cringe when you see how inept so much of what they do is. You know, for instance, we had a situation where there were some officers who were going to boycott Beyonce's concert. Well, I was sent down there to cover it, and, you know, all parties involved basically agreed and agreed where they were going to stand, what they were going to do, and what have you. And it just reeked of something that was truly rehearsed, something that was not really real, you know. And that's kind of it's as if they're playing, you know. And for me, and this is one of the things that I've said to them directly, is quite simply, instead of standing down here yelling across the street, wouldn't that energy be better served if we were utilizing it to build institutions within our community? You know, and there's never a real response to that observation, to that offering. As I spoke about earlier, I was speaking with a young student who is trying his best to fashion himself as the next great Muslim leader. He went off on a tangent on me that was just like stupefying, where he begins to talk about how the people need to be put on notice that he's coming. And when he come, boy, it ain't going to be a good thing, because he getting ready to straighten this stuff out. They're going to need to straighten up, or they're going to have to get out this city. You know, and I'm just like, what in the hell are you even talking about? You know, and, you know, it's a continuation of the same thing they've always done, which is talk, 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 and nothing ever gets done. And I yield with that, Queen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hmm. Well, we've talked over about the need to find what leadership quality we have within ourselves, and find our piece of the puzzle, if you will, and role that we need to play in making sure that we become active in our communities. And Dr. Jones in Houston, I'm in Cincinnati, but we are all involved in things that reach way beyond our city. So I just want to encourage those who are listening to, you know, I guess do some sort of self-assessment and find out what it is that you either are good at or that you like to do, and offer it as an asset to other people in the community. And Dr. Jones, we were able to accomplish a lot with very little in my community, because we did that very thing with very little to no money. We had a few contributors that would help us out every now and again, and it seems like that would always happen, like right at the, you know, most appropriate time, like when we were down to almost nothing. And it's always been a catalyst, if you will, or I guess just enough of a shot in the arm to keep on going. So people would be surprised at some of the things that they would find in their communities and with their neighbors and family members, even that we may have lost contact with over the years as assets in our community, because we do have a lot of talented people in our community. We're just not working together, I guess, enough, and spending enough time, like you said, I guess reinforcing the positive things that we contribute, not only to our families, but to society as a whole. This society would not be what it is today if it weren't for us. So you know, I'm prayerful that we're going to start out loving each other more than we've been taught to hate ourselves. And I yield back to you.
You know, you're definitely the eternal optimist, and I would like to believe what you're saying in regards to us loving ourselves more and more. And I do believe that Black folk do love themselves at a certain level and within certain conditions. But we need to have that love be transformed into organization and activism. And we need to definitely do a much better job of working together to make one another aware of what the left hand often doesn't know what the right hand is doing within the movement. And that's something that we definitely need to tackle with all our might and all our vigor, because without that, without communication, we don't even have the ability to come up with a very even decent strategy to attack those and counterbalance those who have historically taken us to the woodshed for whatever reason. And I yield with that, Queen.
Yep. Well, that's why we're here. That's why we're trying to make a difference in the conversations even that we have, because that's where it starts. You know, we're going to have to rebuild an atmosphere of trust before we can even think about loving one another, and we have to be honest in it in order to, you know, get that far. So, Dr. Jones, when we get together on next Tuesday, do you have a topic in mind that we can go ahead and kind of prepare for?
Wow. You know, one of the things that I would like to look at and like to deal with is the idea of American Reconstruction, that little sliver of time, a little 11-year period between 1865 and 1876. It is a moment where black folk miraculously were able to put two black men into the U.S. Senate. It is a moment where black folk were able to begin their own land ownership. And it is also a moment that sees the creation of the Ku Klux Klan. And in that 11-year period, we see African Americans politically mobilized, becoming economically free. They're finally free physically of American chattel slavery. But within 11 short years, we see all of that fall apart. I'd like to take a look at what we did and then what they did, how it fell apart, how all things just fell apart.
Okay, I'm writing this down. You know, it just so happens I'm a docent for the Cincinnati Museum Center. I play a hairdresser by the name of Eliza Potter, and she wrote a book called The Hairdresser's Guide to High Society, and that is her time period. And the thing about Eliza is that she disappeared, Dr. Jones. I cannot find where she was buried. I cannot find how she passed away. There are some records of her marriage. She was married twice, and she had three children. But that's all I can find, even in the census records. So she wrote that book, and she basically was the rag magazine, if you will, that told how high society Europeans worked and talked about each other and got things done, even if it was backhanded against one another behind closed doors, in order to maintain their high society. But that's my time period. So yeah, I would love to engage in that discussion and talk about some of the things that happened both here on a local level in Cincinnati and from a national perspective. So we have our homework, everybody. Dr. Jones, do you have anything in closing that you would like to share with the listeners? And again, if you're listening on your phone, push 1. If you have a comment, you're listening on your computer, 917-889-8059, as we get ready to close out this Wednesday evening. And I yield back to you, Dr. Jones.
You know, principally, I don't have anything to say. I'm just happy to be back on the air with you. And, you know, hope we're doing some good for the people. And I yield with that.
Ashe, likewise. We in this together. So thank you, Dr. Jones. Thank you to all the listeners. Thank you for those who just listened and chose not to chime in. We appreciate your energy no matter what, because you could be anywhere, but you chose to be with us. And again, we want to remind those to please go to GoFundMe and look up Sister Mary Neal's GoFundMe page. I do believe they are almost at their destination point for their donations to have Sister Mary's home going. So we love you, Sister Mary, and we're going to miss you here on Sign of the Times. Thank you, Dr. Jones. We'll see everybody tomorrow night live and in living color with myself and Queen Dara from the Mothers and Family Free Alabama Movement and the Peace and Unity Movement. We'll see you then. Peace, everybody.
Peace.
Many people wonder where my secret lies. I'm not cute or built to suit a fashion model size. When I start to tell them, they think I'm telling lies. I say, it's in the reach of my arms, the span of my hips, the stride of my step, the curl of my lips. I'm a woman, phenomenally. I walk into a room just as cool as you please, and to a man the fellows stand or fall down on their knees. Then they swarm around me, a hive of honeybees. I say, it's the fire in my eyes, the flash of my teeth, the swing in my waist, the joy in my feet. I'm a woman, phenomenally. Men themselves have wondered what they see in me. They try so much, but they can't touch my inner mystery. When I try to show them, they say they still can't see. I say, it's in the arch of my back, the sun of my smile, the ride of my breast, the grace of my style. I'm a woman, phenomenally. Now you understand just why my head's not bowed. I don't shout or jump about or have to talk real loud. When you see me passing, it ought to make you proud. I say, it's in the click of my heels, the bend of my hair, the palms of my hands, the need for my care, because I'm a woman, phenomenally, phenomenal woman, all you women, and me.